Shall I kick off?
Absolutely.
All right. So, lawyer cybersecurity, well, it's kind of scary. And one reason we're talking about this today, I think I was able to convince Sarah to do this, because I've been, and maybe many of you have been, to so many cybersecurity programs. I'm just completely tired of being completely scared to death to no productive purpose. They all start with headlines like this. You know, bad things have happened to somebody, they're going to happen to you. Here's another set. Lawyer cybersecurity is scary. Can we just stipulate that? But we want to give you, I think, we hope, some productive, positive things you can do. That's the hope today. So with that, let me turn to one of my favorite quotes about technology. I don't know if any of you remember the Wall Street Journal's longtime tech columnist, Walt Mossberg. He wrote in English. He didn't read it. He didn't write in geek speak. He also had this unfailing focus on the user. And so the first line of his first column back in 1991 is there on your screen. And by the way, in your books, you have a sort of version of what's on your screen back at E98, if you can't see the screen from where you are. But what he wrote, the first line of his first column was, personal computers are just too hard to use, and it isn't your fault. And he went on from there to explain things to those of us who needed to use computers. And our view today is lawyer cybersecurity is scary. It isn't our fault. It doesn't have to be, and we can each be a little safer tomorrow than today. And how can we do that? Well, we think you can do that by learning a little bit today, a few things today, and by committing to learn a little bit more going forward about tech and a little bit at a time and doing it continuously. So today's topic, we're going to talk first about all those ethics opinions that Sarah pushed over into the last hour. I said we're going to talk about it in detail. We might not talk about them in detail, but we're going to talk about them for a few minutes at least to tell you why they're important. And then we're going to talk about literally a smorgasbord of things you can do today to protect yourself from viruses and hackers and ransomware and all kinds of other things, as well as from everyday dangers like losing your phone or your laptop. So,
and it's worth mentioning at this point, what you've got in the book is sort of a prose version of the PowerPoint slides, but if you go to our website, one of our frustrations with cybersecurity programs is walking out the door with all these things to be terrified of and not really having any resources for help. And so if you go to the Tennessee Law Institute's website, which is on the bottom of your citation update, but go to TN Law Institute, TN Law Institute, /ethics, and you'll find that the PowerPoint presentation is there, but there are additional resources at the bottom of a variety of the slides. Now, this is a very secure site. But there is a password. I'm being facetious, but there is a password to access the ethics materials. You would never guess that it is TLI 2019.
I mean, these aren't state secrets, but they're for you. They're not for every Joe Schmo or whatever. But so at the bottom of each page, as Sarah said, you're going to see some notes, and most of them are sources where you can go pull an article about how to do something, how to set up a VPN or whatever. We'll talk about that. But
again, the password is TLI 2019.
So, toward the end of The Godfather 2, I'll tie it up, I promise, arguably, of course, the finest motion picture ever made, Don Corleone, is talking with his lawyer, Michael, who is the Don at that point, is talking, I'm sorry, I got a little tangled up there. But anyway, Michael is talking with his lawyer, Tom Hagen, of course, about killing his nemesis, Hyman Roth, right? Hagen, played by Robert Duvall, says, it just can't be done, Michael, given the circumstances. But Michael, Al Pacino, of course, disagrees. He says, Tom, you know, you surprise me. If anything in this life is certain, if history has taught us anything, it's that you can kill anyone. So, yes, if somebody wants to hack your firm, if some disgruntled former employee or some litigation opponent you crushed last year wants to hack or destroy your firm systems or bring your office to a complete halt, they can hire a hacker to do this. A teenage kid or a Russian on the dark web. They can do that, and there's probably nothing you can do to stop them. But here's what you can do, okay? You can make it harder for them. You can encourage those not as motivated as Michael Corleone to find something new to do, something easier to do. You can ensure that even if some ransomware attack locks up every bit of data your firm has, you still have a solid backup somewhere ready to bring up so you can get back to work and not pay anybody any Bitcoin. And you can protect yourself also against fires and floods and your own mistakes. That's what you can do. And so our goal today is, as it says on the screen, it's not to be perfectly safe. It's not to merely meet your ethical obligations, these ABA opinions and such, but to be safer tomorrow from all those dangers than you are today, okay? And to continue beyond today to improve your security gradually a little bit at a time. That's the goal. So I think, Sarah, you talked a little bit about resources, but let's see. The notes, they're in the notes of the PowerPoint presentation on the web. Talk about your new best friend. Everybody's new best friend.
Everybody's new best friend needs to be their tech guru, the guy that you call. You know, when things go wrong at home, the toilet overflows or whatever, maybe you're good at fixing those things yourself, but a whole lot of us call the guy. Well, when it comes to computers and cybersecurity, it has gotten much more complicated. And you need to have somebody, you need to have the guy or gal to call, the tech guru. And there are companies that, some law firms are large enough that they have somebody on staff or four people on staff that can triage these things. But there are companies, TLI uses one. You know, we're a little company. We don't have, knock on wood, many computer problems, but we have a company that will come help us when things go wrong. And, you know, it's great if your son who's a junior in college is really good at computers, but when you're talking about your client's information and your billing information and your bookkeeping information, you really need somebody of the caliber to protect your cyber resources. And there's a really good book. It's cited for you in the middle of, I guess it's page E98. You've got a copy there. It's an ABA publication. It's called the 2019 Solo and Small Firm Legal Technology Guide by three pretty well-known authors, and we've given you information about where you can obtain it. But talk about that book a little bit.
It's good. Here's the point. The point is it's in English. There are a couple of things that are even funny in here. But if you need to know, for example, I just flipped randomly to a page on OCR software, optical character recognition. You know, you take somebody else's pleading, you scan it, it turns into, you know, readable text. Page and a half, page and three quarters about where you might go for that kind of software. It names names, it names products, it says if you want to buy a laptop, it gives a recommendation on what line of Dell computers is, you know, priced appropriately, reliable enough, et cetera. It's very practical, it's very basic, it's very in English, very much in English. And it's not just, if you're solo, it's the Solo and Small Firm Legal Technology Guide. That's cool. I mean, it's for you. But I will tell you, I mean, I'm in a big firm, and I have used it and continue to use it. They put it out every year. It's a nice investment. It's not going to answer all your security questions, but some of the things we recommend today, for example, like VPNs or things like that, they have a few pages on that to get you started. So it's a great resource from that perspective. Okay. So, and by the way, in case you have any doubt, it's not just, you know, the fate of your law firm and your ability to feed your spouse and children or, you know, whatever, that it's not just you, right, and your partners caring about this. Clients are actually watching this, okay? This is a couple of quotes from an article in Inc. magazine, and it's seven questions to ask your lawyer about data security, because small businesses and even individual clients are starting to wise up, just like our bigger clients have, that, hey, they care whether you are secure or not. So look at these questions. These are legitimate questions. If you were a client, you ought to ask another lawyer. When are you encrypting my information? You know, that's one of them. Another one is, what about physical security, right? What does your firm do to avoid social engineering, phishing attacks, things like that? So don't be under any illusion that what we're doing is in private and secret from our clients. They know exactly the risks we have, and we need to be cognizant of that. So,
and if you have more sophisticated clients, the ones where they send you a request for a proposal, that they ask these questions.
Yep.
They want to know exactly what you're doing to make their information safe.
If any of you represent banks, even small banks, but certainly bigger banks, you will have seen, we talked about outside counsel guidelines, we may talk about them a little more, you will see those kind of questionnaires or requirements or whatever, and it's a really, really painful process for some firms these days. But let's kick over to ethics a little bit. You want to kick off where we are on ethical or obligations generally and ethical obligations?
Well, and they're found in different places. Of course, we have our handy-dandy ethics rules that talk about everything from client confidentiality to keeping clients' information safe to communicating with clients. So obviously the ethics rules are one source of information. There's also the standard of care for attorneys, something which in the cybersecurity world has certainly morphed over time.
Look at the Lawrence case, Leventhal, whatever it was, the case we talked about from New York about digital photos, right? I mean, you know, it's not hard to imagine a malpractice scenario where somebody, a lawyer, doesn't make that kind of determination, is not aware of how to review digital photos the other side send them. That could be a breach of the standard of care soon.
Well, even something as simple as, I can remember, I guess it was an ABA formal opinion not that many years ago, asking the question, can you keep information in the cloud?
Right.
And it was like, oh my God, in the cloud, where is that? And who can reach it? And what can they do with it? And now the pendulum has swung back in the other direction where you may have an obligation
we're going to talk about that. Absolutely.
Back up stuff by keeping it in the cloud.
And the ABA opinions, we'll get to those in a minute, but they're a good barometer on that. But then also, I mean, so that's a malpractice duty, a fiduciary duty, right? And contract. Think contract. Think outside counsel guidelines, where the company says, the bank says, we're not hiring you unless you agree to our 20-page outside counsel guidelines. They may have cybersecurity obligations. And then, by the way, you've got obligations under other law. You know, if you do work for certain healthcare companies, HIPAA certainly applies. Many of you will have signed business associate agreements, for example, with some healthcare clients, where you agree to honor their privacy, their confidentiality obligations, right? Or data breach notification laws, which every state, pretty much, including Tennessee, has now. So.
And by the way, and we may have this in another slide later on, but if you're dealing with those clients, those typically corporate clients that have those kinds of rules, you need to have somebody in your firm who is reading them. And
of all things.
Preferably one person or a couple of people that read all of them that can make sure that the firm is familiar with what is generally required, that you generally follow that. And oh, here's one that's got something brand new in it that we've never done before, but if we're agreeing we're going to do it, then by golly, we've got to do it.
Somebody's got to do it, right? And by the way, maybe it's not a two-lawyer firm problem. I'm not sure about that. But it's a five-lawyer firm problem. And one of the concerns big firms have also is making sure the firm, knows, right? So if you're a five-lawyer firm and partner one has agreed to something and thrown it in her file, and partner five has agreed to something and thrown it in her file, does the firm know? Does somebody who's got to go talk to the IT person and make it happen know? Do you know whether they conflict? So this is, again, not a big firm issue only. So, and that might be. We'll skip that slide when we come to it. But let's talk about the ethics rules just for a minute. So you want to talk about this one, or shall I?
Go ahead.
All right, rule 1.1. This is the ethics portion of the program that the CLE Commission will approve the whole hour because of, but we will not spend an hour on it. So 1.1. 1.1 is competence. Now under comment 8 to rule 1.1, part of our duty of competence toward clients includes the keeping abreast of changes, including the benefits and risks associated with relevant technology. So you don't need to be using an iPhone for client work unless you know how to make it secure or know your tech guru can help you make it secure. You have to know that much about technology, okay? So that's rule 1.1, we have a duty of competence. And if you're gonna handle digital photos like lawyer Leventhal, you have to have some competence in doing that, okay? Now, he's not gonna get a second bite at the apple on that. Let's see, so that's rule 1.1. Rule 1.6, we've added in Tennessee, as in something like 30 or 40 other states, a new section that says what we already knew in substance, but makes it clearer and crisper, that a lawyer shall make reasonable efforts, that's the magic language, to prevent the inadvertent or unauthorized disclosure of, or unauthorized access to, client confidential information. So the magic words are, the new term of art is reasonable efforts. And so the question is, if you get hauled in on discipline charges after you let somebody, you do something that lets somebody break into your client confidential information in your firm, is did you make reasonable efforts? Okay, so, and by the way, the comments to Rule 1.6 now have some interesting, helpful stuff. We're going to talk about that more in a minute. My view is that is a minimum standard. That is a disciplinary standard. Nobody in this room wants that to be the end of their efforts. Nobody. So we're going to talk about it for a minute, and then we're going to move on to what what we really should be doing.
There's an ABA opinion. Are we to that slide
yep,
yet?
That's where we are.
477R, yep. And I guess the way you've described this is that half of it is about this topic.
Well, yeah, here's what I would say. We got three ethics opinions, two of which were in the book this year,
right?
That have come out in the last 2 years. They make a nice set. I jokingly said the last time that they're really two and a half opinions, but okay, I don't want to, whatever. But this is the first of them, 477R. You'll see it's a riff almost entirely on what reasonable efforts are, okay? How that applies to different technologies and different situations. It's you know, written in ABA ethics opinion language, so it's not quite English, but it's close. And this and the other two, one useful thing about them, apart from educating you about your responsibilities, is that when you do sit down with your tech guru from time to time, it is a way for you to communicate to them, not being lawyers, what your obligations are, what it looks from your end of the telescope, so they can understand what target they're going to meet. Hopefully they've worked with lawyers before, but nevertheless, it's a way to help help with your communication to the people who are going to implement your tech, your security, your security on your tech system.
Well, and this is the one that talks about what's reasonable in terms of protecting client information, not just on how you use your iPhone, but what happens if your laptop gets stolen.
Absolutely.
Or what happens if, and I won't say whether anybody on this podium might be guilty of this, but you know that little bowl on the desk that's got 12 flash drives in it?
Oh, yeah.
Various client information, and the two that are in the briefcase that I take with me everywhere.
I think I've got two in here, but anyway, yeah.
And you lose that, and those are...
Right.
Mine are not encrypted.
Right.
And so keeping up with that and cleaning them up, getting, you know...
Being careful what you use them for, et cetera. So, yeah,
exactly.
It's a broad-ranging... I mean, literally, it is supposed to... is structured as... That opinion, 477R, is structured as what does the law, what does the ethics rule say about your ethical obligation to protect all client confidential information? So it's a framework opinion. So it's useful. It's not the end of the story, but it's useful. This one, the next one, 483, that's the latest in the trio. This is about what your obligations are once bad stuff happens, once there's a hack, once there's a data breach. The headlines include, you got a duty to monitor for a data breach, to know if something's happened to your data, right? You got a duty to figure out if you think something's happened, what happened, if anything happened, what happened. You've got a duty to respond and get your systems back in place. And you may, this was the real headline in the articles about this that came out, is what are you required to do in terms of notification of clients? Because it's not very hard to get to understand that if under both your ethics duty about telling clients about material developments in their matters or under your fiduciary duty, perfect candor, if somebody steals a laptop that has a lot of their protected medical information where it's available, where they can get at it, is that a material development in the representation? I think so. Well, I think it is. So do you have a duty? Under what circumstances? What if it's encrypted, for example, and can't be got at? You know, how sure do you have to be about that? But this duty to notify clients is a serious issue. This opinion goes into that. And then the final point there is it reminds us that we have obligations under other law. For example, if you've got somebody else's medical information, for example, on your laptop, maybe the plaintiff's, and you're defending the case, you might well have an obligation to notify the opposing party if that unencrypted information gets stolen, perhaps. So this is a place to go, you know, it's not the first thing to do when something bad like that happens, but it's probably the second. The first thing, as we'll talk about, is going to be call your tech guru. The half opinion, the other opinion, is this 482, which again Sarah mentioned earlier. Floods, fires, hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes. You know, it basically says we've got an ethics obligation to prepare for those. I think it's more than an ethics obligation. I think it's a survival, obligation. I mean, in Memphis we worry about the big one hitting, the earthquake hitting. But,
This is a good example of one where if you go to our website,
exactly,
there are a number of resources listed about, including a bunch of ABA disaster recovery resources. This has been a hot topic ever since Hurricane Katrina, for sure.
And the ABA pulled right after Katrina. They got a fellow from New Orleans, really smart guy, put up a task force, and they collected every bit of good information they could on what we can do. Sample disaster recovery plans. They drafted some. All of it's in one place on the ABA website. That's really useful. But, when you think about it, I mean, I don't know if it's likelier that, some Russian teenager, in the higher ups, your ex-litigation opponents is going to take your firm down, or whether it's likelier a tornado is going to hit you. I think my money's on the tornado. But, that's wishful thinking. But it is a serious point. And one of the one thing you mentioned earlier that a friend of mine, actually the author of this book, mentioned to me about a month ago. She said, well, really what I think is important about this, about these opinions, is that they show this the pendulum swing. That, used to be we're talking, oh my, can we use the cloud? And now these opinions, you read them, you come away with a very distinct impression that it's really, really good to use the cloud. Because, for example, whether it's a tornado that trashes your office, including all your servers and your paper, or if it's ransomware that locks down your system, having all your information either in the cloud or backed up to the cloud could save your life, So the cloud has become, we've gotten more comfortable with it as security has improved, and we'll talk a little more about that, but point being, it's another part of the change that technology is going through, where we have gotten more comfortable with the cloud. Anyway.
But I still am a big believer in, I like my paper. The people that can try a lawsuit with an iPad, not me, not now, not ever. And I believe in also having a physical backup, where if you can't get to the cloud because there is no power in Knoxville, Tennessee, because of a tornado or an ice storm or whatever, but you have a physical backup of what was on your server, you can go to Norcross, Georgia, to a facility there, and you can rebuild your system and have everything you need, all the information that was on your computer system. You want a backup in the office, you want a backup in the cloud, but this is triple redundancy, and big corporations do it this way.
Well, my view about this is pretty simple. Just like everybody in the room uses all this fancy technology differently. Some people live only on their phone. I don't know how people read pleadings on their phones. I don't get that. But in any event, some people do that. Some people have to be on a laptop. Some people, whatever. Okay, if you're doing what I think you should do, these issues that Sarah's talking about, you go have a meeting with your IT person, your tech guru, and you say, okay, are we doing the best we can do, given the options we've got? I'm a paper person. Help me set up a backup plan so that a paper person can practice law after the tornado hits. And there will be a perfectly acceptable solution that might be totally different for one person in the audience versus another. But it ought to be thoughtful. You ought to think about it. All right, here's a quiz for you. Everybody pull your phone out. I mean, those of you who don't already have it out, checking your email. Pull your phone out. Seriously, I'm serious. Pull your phone out. I'm not joking. Pull your phone out. All right. I want you to see I want hands shown of everybody who can, on their phone, bring up the phone number of the tech person they're going to call when tonight at 9:30 they discover that somebody has stolen their laptop from their car. Oh, yeah. This is good. Oh, good. Good. This is good.
This is better than we've seen.
It is, actually. The rest of you, it's okay. But just, maybe you know the name, but you know the number in your phone. Okay. Within the next 24 hours, really, do put it in your phone. By the way, footnote, because we may not get to that part of this presentation, I'm increasingly convinced that one of the single most important things and the easiest things you can do today to prepare for the end of the world as we know it from an IT point of view, right, the tornado or hack or ransomware, keep your contacts up to date. I mean, not just your family, but all your clients and other counsel and all that, because, you know, I don't know about you, but my contacts live on my phone, on my laptop, on the computer I got at work. I think my secretary has access to them. They're everywhere. It's so easy. It's not like you got to retype them five times, right? So, you know, and it's not
but
just your check group.
Not everybody keeps the same contacts in the same places.
I'm fine with that. But
the contacts on your phone may include every client you've got. The contacts of every client I have are on the computer system at the office, but they're not in my cell phone.
Well, my only point is that is actually a security measure that helps you in a disaster. Technology these days, that's right. First of all, you got to find the people in your firm. Okay? I mean, by the way, I'm with a firm that's been through this a number of times. And first priority is to be able to get a hold of everybody in the firm and make sure, number one, they're okay. They're alive and reasonably well. And maybe their family is too, you know. But you got to know, even if they're not able to get to work today, where they're going to get there tomorrow, right? So that is a simple sort of stupid thing that we sometimes forget how important that is. Anyway, end of that homily. All right, so you need this person not just to be available tonight at 9:30, okay? You need this person or conceivably somebody else, I grant that, to answer your daily questions, to help you plan for backups, to, when you get a new phone, make sure that you have set it right to protect yourself, okay? To answer questions like we get to this on Wi-Fi, using public Wi-Fi, and we'll mention their options. Go to your tech guru and say, okay, I understand there's sort of two schools of thought. What do you think? And candidly, I would probably not want to have a tech person who I didn't take their judgment on stuff. So you need daily questions answered, you need emergency response, and you need somebody you trust. By the way, one other thing on that. They need to talk English. I'm not trying to be snide. If you ask them, hopefully you'll have two or three things you write down from today about what you ought to do. If you go home and you ask them about it, you say, okay, VPN, what's a VPN? Do we have one? How do I use it? Should I use it? If they can't give you an answer within minutes of that you understand about that subject, you need a new tech guru. It's not your fault. Okay, if you don't understand all the they need to be able to understand it. Just like our clients they're not lawyers and they don't speak lawyer. And if we can't explain to them what their problem is in English, we're not going to be doing it for them very long. So in any event, end of that homily, but tech guru, get a tech guru if you don't have one. All right.
The next one is tremendously important. Patch and update your software promptly and consistently. And I guess it's on the slide that when Verizon had that big data breach in 2016, there were vulnerabilities dating back.
Oh, this is from others. They're reporting on others, not themselves. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, don't blame them yet. I'm sure we'll get to that. But anyway.
But there have been folks who haven't updated things since 2003 or 2006. Those update notices you get are there for a reason. And I'm always a little apprehensive because it seems like you install one and the next morning on the Today Show you're hearing about how 14
right.
million people had a problem with this patch.
Exactly.
So maybe you wait 2 days. Or maybe you just put them on automatically and know that there'll be a patch to fix the patch if it didn't work right. But
and that is the prevailing wisdom. The prevailing wisdom is, if you can't trust the patch, if you can't trust the update, and you can't take it automatically, you don't need to be using the software. Because none of us are smart enough to keep up with this stuff. And if it's some piece of software you can't trust for that purpose, and more importantly, your tech guru tells you don't use that. But if they tell you use it, almost all of them will tell you set it to automatic and forget it. So for what that's worth.
And again, many resources about this on our website.
One other thing on that. Don't use software that is totally out of life. Windows 7, I believe, is going out of life, meaning Microsoft will not support it anymore, at I think January. So if you got some Windows 7 machines at your office, put it on your list to talk to your tech person. Hey, I understand Microsoft's not helping us out with Windows 7 anymore. We got any of those machines? And what your tech person will probably say without your asking is, oh yeah, we got three of those. Yeah, I'm getting rid of those this fall. That's not a problem. So that's important. All right, number four. Are we at the same? Hang on, sorry, I'm behind. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, a lot of your devices, a lot of your apps have stuff, have tweaks that can enhance security. My favorite example is Office 365. We've probably got nothing wrong with it, so Office 365. People use Office 365? Really? Okay, yeah. Lawyers love it. It's really great. But it's not the right way to put it. They have this app in there called Secure Score. Apparently it's easy to find. And it evaluates the security of the options you've picked in installing the software. Okay, so I'm not sure 273 is the highest score, but I think it is, because the default settings out of the box, so to speak, on Office 365 is 79 out of 273, meaning that you can tweak more options to make it way more secure. Now, my first question about that is, why? This means that your tech person, one of the things you will have them do is when you start using Office 365, you will say, hey, is this as secure as it needs to be? What settings do I need to use? Just like you would on your phone. And there are a lot of apps that work that way. Dropbox, for example. We talked about this a couple of years ago, as I recall.
The generic cheap version of Dropbox is not secure.
The free one.
The free one. And if that's how your client is sending you her medical records or his bank statements, that's just not hard at all to hack into.
So generally, although I know this is counterintuitive, because I don't like this answer, free is bad, paid is good. I'm just saying.
That must be killing you to
say
that.
It is. She knows how cheap I am. I'm very, very, very cheap. I don't even know what Dropbox is, but like Google or Gmail, there's a like $50 a year product that gives you more features and it gives you more security. It also, by the way, and I bet this is true for Dropbox, we looked at this a couple years ago too. You read the terms of service on free Google, where you can get a free Gmail account. You read it for the $50 a year service that's aimed at office people. So it's $50 a year. You looked at the two terms of service. Over here for free, no obligation of confidentiality. They own your data. They can sell it. They can use it. Over here, they got at least some minimal obligation of confidentiality to you. That's kind of typical, we understand. So, all right, so what else? Oh, other tweaks. These are obvious, I hope. Tweak your software, we say. All right, mobile devices. There are lots of things you can do on mobile devices. Passwords.
Have you got any password examples for us, Mr. Perry?
I do. Some of you may know that there's a company called Splash Data that does a list every year of the worst passwords. My recollection is they work off of stolen password databases. And so these are, the most common and the worst, right? So any guess as to the worst, number one worst annual this year password? No, I'm sorry, that's number two. Number one is 123456. Number three is 123456789. Number four is 123456789. Right, you get the picture. QWERTY is one. Right. This year, the headline is Donald makes it onto annual worst password list. Donald is now number 23 of the top 25. I think someone tweeted they were unhappy with that. I think only made it to 20. Anyway.
Only made it to 23.
Yeah. Anyway, so use a good password. Figure out how to do that. Ask your tech guru. Maybe more about passwords in a few minutes. But we're talking about devices. Use a password. If it is not the standard of care today that all of our mobile devices need to have a password and need to have a good one, not just one of these, it's going to be in about 15 minutes. So you don't want to be the guy who lost your phone and it has no password. You really don't. And by the way, if you've got an iPhone, you simply put a password in it, and it is encrypted. And that's done.
We saw Android, that in, what case was that? It was one of the shooting cases.
Oh, yeah, San Bernardino shooter, that's right. And their encryption was good enough that the FBI had to pay like $1 million to some Israeli consultants to crack the phone. So, that's pretty good for a consumer device, So, anyway, use passwords. Find my iPhone.
Tell us
about that.
It is a really cool app. Of course, you've got it on your iPhone. You've also got it on your computer and maybe your iPad. So when you lose your iPhone, you go to one of your other devices or just go to the internet some other way.
Right.
And search Find My iPhone, and it will show you with such degree of specificity where your phone is. True story. My phone had slipped out of my pocket in row 5 of some airplane that I'd flown back to Knoxville from somewhere, and get out to the car and realize I don't have my phone. And I need my phone. What am I, well, you know, we can't exist for 10 minutes without our phone. So I take out my iPad, I find my iPhone, and I could tell it was still on the airplane at gate 6 at McGee Tyson Airport. I go back in, explain my problem. A kind person at TSA let me through, and I get down to the gate, and I see the pilot open a window in the cockpit and toss my phone down to one of the grounds crew people who brought it inside for me.
And fortunately, the grounds crew person caught it.
Caught it. Very well. It's a good thing I wasn't one
the
for
story,
all that.
We would not be hearing this story if it just landed on the tarmac.
It really is very, very helpful.
Backups, we'll talk about them more. But again, any mobile device, remote wiping, you probably know that your mobile carrier can, if you call them and say, I've lost my iPhone or my Android, typically they can wipe it the next time it comes online, which is a nice thing if you don't know where it is, to have a thief not have
just
it either.
Just take all the data off of it.
You know what a LoJack is, right? As to a car, there's a piece of software called LoJack for laptops. Does the same thing. All right, and a VPN. We're going to talk about VPNs. All right, number 5. Where's your data, Sarah?
Well, if I've done things right, it is on a on our data management software package on the server in the office, which is also backed up on the cloud. Now, if it's data that just came in an email and I have neglected to associate it, that's a problem. If it's only located on a flash drive where I typed it up at home and saved it to the flash drive, which I have now lost, that's a bad thing. And another problem that we have, we mentioned information being on an associate's personal iPad. Be aware of the fact that if you're on one of these friends and family type plans and you have multiple devices, I discovered to my surprise one day that my iPad is sunk with my phone, to the extent that if I get a phone call or a message, it shows up on the iPad. Well, I'm dealing with a very sensitive issue with a client. We're sending emails back and forth, and my husband's using my iPad to look at something else. And I keep hearing the same message ding, and said, stop, put it down. That's got confidential information. You cannot use it. Yeah. Go find your own iPad.
You know, the moral of that is that because of convenience, we love the convenience, our data lives everywhere. It's just ridiculous. And that means, by the way, that you know your tech guru, you're going to have a pretty close relationship with your tech guru, because you know they're going to need to know where your data is, right? They're going to need, how many of you are old enough to remember
it's
this?
10 p.m. Do you know where your children are?
Those of you who are younger may not know, but back, I guess it would be 11 p.m. in this time zone, right? But before the local news came on, that was back in the 70s. It was a little public service announcement. So do you know where your data is? Really? Do you? Anyway, so that's something you're going to have to figure out, and you'll never have a perfect answer for that. I hate to tell you, but anyway. Encryption. Oh, wait, I jumped past that too far. Short course on encryption, very short course, is there are two types. There's data at rest and data in motion. Data at rest means the data that's here in this machine or this laptop. In motion, it's going between here and the server back home at my law firm. Both of those need to be encrypted. Typically, this is a question for your tech guru. Like I said, on iPhones, you plug in any numeric code, you have a password, it's already encrypted. In terms of in transit, that's a setting on your server or on your phone or both. But again, you don't need to know that, in my opinion, but you need to know that it's something you need. Let's see here. Let me turn the page here. Oh, by the way, why? Just so you know, it helps me remember why we care. You got a laptop, right? Why do you encrypt it at rest? Well, and you have a password too. Why do you need both? You need both because the password gets you into it, you know, with the keyboard and all that, and into your stuff. But let's assume for a moment that you're using a good password, and let's assume a thief steals it, and they realize you got a good password. They say, forget that, crack the laptop open, pull the hard drive out, plug it up to another machine. They don't need no stinking password, all right? But if it's encrypted, they still can't get it, okay? And it makes a difference in terms of whether the data is available to somebody else. So it's terribly important to encrypt. All right, and by the way, any device you ought to be using today ought to let you encrypt. Backups. You've talked a little about backups, Sarah. Anything else you want to add on that?
Maybe just the last thing that's mentioned here. I think we've pretty well covered everything else. But that last item, have your tech guru restore your backup data occasionally. Gosh, we use this backup, and it's going to be great, and it's going to be wonderful. And then you have the flood or the tornado, and somebody tries to restore that backup, and it doesn't work. Then it's not doing you any good.
Exactly.
And that's why these big companies will have disaster recovery trips to these companies, the one in Denver, the one in Norcross, and rebuild their entire system at least once a year to make sure that it works right.
Exactly. All right, that's backup. Oh, passwords. We talked about passwords. One thing to add there, password managers. People who use password managers, are there? Surely there are a few. Yeah. Two best technology purchases I ever made, ever. One was a wired headset, well, kind of like this one for my phone at the office. I don't really care about wireless, but, you know, no more of this. The other is a password manager. So the 250 passwords I have, you know, 75 of which, you know, don't matter, I don't have to know them anymore. It's a piece of software that usually they will sync over devices, so your laptop and your phone or whatever, your iPad, that keep all your passwords, will plug them in when you need them without you remembering them, and you need one password to get at it. Now, you don't want to use 123456 as that one password, okay? But here's some examples. These four pieces of pieces of software apps are reputable. Any one of those will do you fine. But a password manager, I mean, frankly, it might change your life. I realize how stupid that sounds, but that's the life we live these days. And by the way, every once in a while, change your good passwords, will you? We talked about this already. Okay. By the way, one thing that'll come up, that may come up several more times, multi-factor authentication or two-factor authentication. Shall I?
Well,
go ahead.
An example.
Yeah.
On my phone, I have a passcode I can use. There's also a facial recognition software. On my iPad, there's a thumbnail or a thumbprint, I guess, that if the certain things have happened, it's been powered off or things of that nature, I have to use that second method of authentication. The only problem is the facial recognition software on my phone. Like a lot of you, first thing I do in the morning is pick up my phone and look at it. It doesn't recognize me thing in the morning.
That's so wrong. Siri, you're just wrong, Siri.
I don't know if it's the makeup or the hair.
Shame you can't just slap Siri, isn't it? It's just a shame. Anyway.
Actually, I've had to turn Siri off.
Oh.
She doesn't understand my East Tennessee twang.
I see.
And
I
most
see.
Of my conversations with her end up with her saying, well, that was uncalled for.
Okay, the Sarah you didn't know. So think of it this way. There are several factors, they call them, of authentication. One is what you know, password, say, for example. One is what you are, your face, your fingerprint. Another is what you have. So, for example, our multi-factor authentication for our firm is it's an app on a phone, a separate device. So if I log into my system on my laptop, it's going to send a little code over here, so I have to get at it over here. So that's something you have. A key fob, for example, that can serve the same purpose. So reason I keep talking about this will help you on a number of fronts. It makes passwords less important. For example, phishing. Again, we're jumping ahead, but phishing emails where somebody, what are they trying to do? They're trying to steal your credentials,
right?
To your bank account, all right? Well, if you got two-factor authentication turned on your bank account, who cares? They're not going to be able to get in without your fingerprint or without your, you know, the app saying yes, right? So I'm not saying really who cares, but it's a serious upgrade in your security to use two-factor authentication. So keep that in mind. All right, let's see, where are we?
Well, I think we've talked about number 9. You want to jump over to metadata scrubbers?
Yep. We know what metadata is now. Short version, be aware that you're giving it out sometimes, right? And even in documents you have to push out, you don't want to give up metadata. Like the
Some
example,
people may not know what metadata
well,
is.
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Metadata is data that is embedded in a document. And going back to a rudimentary example from earlier in cyber history, if I were sending a letter that was typed on by my secretary on her computer with a settlement proposal, we'll settle this case for $50,000. And I send that on to the client to review, and the client says, $50,000? Are you crazy? Ask him for $100,000. Yeah, I know you've told me 50 is reasonable, and I'll probably settle for that, but you tell him $100,000. We're going to negotiate hardball here. So I send that letter, or my secretary does, in Word. The metadata, the underlying data with that original number of $50,000 is still in there. And if you know how to look for it, you can find it. So a metadata scrubber takes it out.
Some people will tell you, and this is a question for your tech guru, that simply turning the Word document into a PDF should get rid of the metadata. I think that's largely true, but nevertheless, sometimes you have to send a Word document, for example. And that, anyway, the bottom line is there is software that will clean it that's only for that purpose. Frankly, the only piece of software I could find that was really well known and accepted is this one mentioned here, Pain Group's Metadata Assistant. It is the dominant one, not that expensive. No.
What was the other related example? Was it in Paul Manafort's case?
Oh, yeah. Well, sort of, yeah, because, I mean, it's not known how to redact.
Right.
So,
What happened.
If you redact, they had a PDF document. It was a brief or a motion, and they redacted a portion of it because it referred to information that was under seal, under a protective order. And they redacted in a way, literally, that they electronically put black over, you know, 5 or 10 or 20 lines, but they didn't then take the underlying document out of the document. And so literally, you could go, and the news media did, go pull that document up on Pacer, hover, you know, highlight that that darkened text that couldn't be read visually, copy it, put it over in a Word document, paste it, and you could see the underlying text.
You could take out the black box and see what had been covered up.
And it, that was in the news cycle for a day or two, how dumb Paul Manafort's lawyers were, and, you know, who wants to be that guy? This is important, and we don't need to spend a huge amount of time on it, but you need to be aware of the context. There are two schools of thought on using public Wi-Fi, like we have here, right?
Absolutely.
You have one particular view, but one view is never, ever, don't ever use public Wi-Fi. It's like, you know, going to a bathroom in Bucksnort. No offense to anybody from Bucksnort. Sorry about Bucksnort. You know, there's certain places you just don't go, right? All right. The other option is use public Wi-Fi, like the one here, but be careful and take some protective measures, okay?
The other one is go to Starbucks and put your credit card number in as you order something on Amazon and see how many other people use it within a very short period of time.
Yeah, you could run a controlled experiment, I suppose, but anyway.
It's been done.
But point being, there are two completely different schools of thought. I don't think either one is necessarily correct, absolutely. But the incorrect answer is to do as Sarah just said. That's the wrong answer. The wrong answer is to use public Wi-Fi without protection, without thinking about it. Talk to your tech guru. Another solution for the hyper-paranoids out there who don't want to use public Wi-Fi at all, have your phone. You can use, generally most new phones will generate a hotspot for you, and you can get the internet on your computer, linking it up to the hotspot on your phone. Or you can buy a better, faster hotspot that you can carry around with you that Verizon or AT&T sell. So that's a way to have your own connection that you can vouch for and make your tech guy make it secure, and you don't have to worry about being paranoid quite so much. But in the other category, think about if you want to use public Wi-Fi, don't be stupid. Check the name of the Wi-Fi that you're using. You know, if it's you're at Starbucks and it's one of them is labeled Starbucks and it's misspelled, don't use that one, okay? And use a VPN.
What is a VPN?
A virtual private network The only, I'm sure there's a better explanation, but I've heard even very sophisticated tech people describe it as a tunnel. If you got a VPN from here to your home office, right? It's a tunnel between this device and some home server, right? And it's encrypted. The tunnel is encrypted. So all the data going back and forth is protected. Okay? And it's easy. It can work in the background completely. Again, this is a question for your tech guy. It's not one. And by the way, if you haven't noticed the theme, my view very strongly is we not only do not, but do not have to be experts on this. We just have to know when to ask the right questions and have somebody we can trust answer them. I don't do real estate law. My firm does. And if I've got a real estate question that's tangential to something I do, I think I can spot it and know to walk down the hall. That's what we're talking about. But it means you have to have that knowledge of when to spot the issue. So anyway,
and
that's
this is
Wi-Fi.
A slide with regard to which there are some really good resources on our website, including 5 tips for staying safe on public Wi-Fi networks, the 3 best VPNs for lawyers in 2019, and my very favorite, how a 7-year-old girl hacked a public Wi-Fi network in 10 minutes. So I tend to be a little more conservative about.
Okay, we don't call it hyper paranoid? Okay, all right.
You do on a regular basis.
That's okay. all right, so catch up the slides here. Okay, this is something new that unless you're in a bigger firm, you've probably not heard of, but it has become almost routine for bigger firms to have a periodic, typically annual, security assessment of their system. The price has come down a lot. There now are services that will do that for smaller firms. And the notion is, it's a second set of eyes. Assume you have a perfect tech guru. He or she is fabulous. You know, they work for your firm. They're there every day. You got their cell number. Okay. But once a year, the theory is it's still good to have a second set of eyes look at security. Our firm has done this for several years now. It never fails that despite we have a great tech area, every year we get the report in and, you know, usually there are some things that aren't, hopefully they're not hypercritical, but that are important that somehow we've missed, okay? But then there's a huge list of things where some, a printer hadn't got the latest software on their network connection, and so somebody could conceivably hack that. I mean, stuff that it's not possible for a human security person to keep up with everything. So that's the notion. That service is available for even smaller companies, smaller firms, smaller outfits. Sometimes it includes penetration testing, having somebody try to get into your system from the outside. I don't think that's absolutely common. And by the way, a number of clients are now requiring and have you certify that you're doing it regularly. It's worth knowing. Let's leave it at that. Vendors, you need to be able to check your vendors out carefully. The thing I'll tell you to remind you about this, and again, your tech guru needs to help you with this, is Target.
Mm-hmm.
Target. The way Target had that horrible, terrible data breach was their HVAC vendor had a breach. So their HVAC vendor had to get into their system because, of course, how can we have air conditioning without network access? I don't, whatever. But somebody got in through their HVAC contractor. So, can't let just anybody into your system. Here are things to talk about or look at with your vendors. Let's see, what else? Where are we now? Let's keep going because we're getting kind of short. Okay, disaster recovery plan. We talked a little about this. There's that opinion. Here are some things to think about on a disaster recovery plan. Again, you could pull up a disaster recovery plan from the ABA's site, and it's a perfectly serviceable plan. But here's some things to think about. Again, contacts, I put it at the top of the list. Power. Do you need a generator? Maybe. I don't know. What about an internet connection? I mean, if your life as a lawyer depends on the internet.
It's in the cloud.
Yeah.
And you can't get there from here.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Because of the ice storm.
Our local internet provider in the Memphis office was down for 2 or 3 days. I think it was Verizon, was down for 2 or 3 days a year or two ago. And fortunately, our system was set up so they could shift to another firm vendor. But I don't know, it may be that it's enough to worry about here if you're a solo, that if you've got a vendor at the office and a vendor at home, that may be as much as you want to think about. But it's probably worth thinking about that. Alternative email, access to contacts, et cetera. Anyway, let's let's see here, where else? There's an incident response plan. Let's keep going.
I think we've covered most of that.
Yep. Let's see here.
And again, there are some really good resources on our website.
So, phishing.
Before we get there, number 16.
I'm sorry.
Last thing under 15.
Okay.
Talk with your insurance broker
cyber
incident insurance before your next renewal. And it's out there. Sometimes it's bundled with other insurance that you might have. Law firms are prime targets from our friends in the insurance business. We need this, and they know it, and will try to sell it to us, and we should be looking at buying it.
And Madam President of the TBA, the TBA actually has a product.
Just a shameless plug.
That's
Tennessee
okay.
Bar Association has a cyber incident insurance product available if you're looking for a place to get it, and it's reasonably priced.
And just to be clear, I would certainly think everybody in the room who's in business as a lawyer needs to be talking to their insurance people once a year. Surely we do that, right? And that ought to be on your list. So that's a simple one, is add that to the list for next year. Phishing.
I don't even want to talk about phishing. I've had, I guess, four different attacks in the last 2 weeks.
Well, you're an important person. Tell them why you're a target today.
Well, because I'm president of the Tennessee Bar and my email's out there, and there are a lot of people that I deal with in the Bar Association, and they keep getting emails that say, "Hey, Joe, I really need you to do me a favor today. Can you email me back, Sarah?" Now, they aren't usually quite that articulately worded, and but it's a short, "Hey, friend, can you help me?" that gets a response. Be glad to. Sarah, what do you need? And then it asks them to go to a Target and buy a bunch of gift cards for video gaming boxes or some such thing I'd never heard of.
I don't know if they've done this to you yet, but I happen to know that prior TBA president, there was an email sent to one of the financial people within the TBA, and it said something effective. It was trying to get them to make a payment. Right, and it was saying essentially that the president was telling the CFO to write a check to so and so. Right. Well, again, if it comes from an email that looks like your email and you're the president, well, that might trick somebody. Our staff was not nearly so easily tricked, as I recall. But those are the kinds of things that, in addition to just looking for your bank credentials, right, or any system credentials.
Well, and in a lot of these phishing emails, if you just if it's something as weird as go buy some gift cards or go to the bank and pull out $900 and I'll pay you back, if you just pause for a minute to look at the email, it's got my name at the top, and then when you hover over it and look at the email address, it's marthasoandso@gmail.com. Well, that's not me. Now, the last one that went out under my name, it actually had my Lewis Thomason address. It was a really good one, but the language that was used, it appeared to have been translated from another country. It wasn't the kind of vernacular anyway that this little Southern gal would use, and so that's what tipped the first person who got it off to, okay, they're at it again,
yeah.
Sarah.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like Sarah. That's a legitimate response, and it's you can't check your brain out when you're reading your email, right? Training. There is training available on phishing. There is some free training available on the web that you can use with your office. If you feel like that's something that you want to do, that's not hard to do. The other item here, I mentioned this a while ago, multi-factor authentication. If you notice, again, a theme. If you use two-factor authentication, it reduces your exposure to phishing. It took me easily a year to figure out why people kept saying that. But they say it because, well, okay, what are they stealing? They're stealing your credentials. Well, they're not stealing all of my credentials if I have to have a fingerprint to get into, it, or if I have to have, they have to get, use an app to get into my firm system. So that's, again, that's something doable. You can do that, okay? You can do that on your email and all your systems. Talk to your tech person about it.
One other thing that was on, I guess, the prior slide, but we don't want to overlook this or minimize it. If you get an email, and maybe I get an email from Lucian, and it's got an attachment, and it says, here's the document we discussed, and we haven't discussed a document.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's an email from an acquaintance or another lawyer, somebody that maybe even one of my partners in Memphis or something, but I haven't had any communication with him, and the name of the document is not something that makes any sense to me. Don't open that attachment. It's going to be malware.
Or call the person.
Wait, yeah, you could call them.
I mean,
that's
you could actually have human contact with somebody.
But we get stuff from our tech folks all the time saying, if you get an email from so-and-so today, please do not open the attachment.
Which is another, yet human contact is vastly underrated, first of all. But also, what you just said, I mean, I don't care if you're a three-person law firm. It's worth telling your partners if you just saw something like this. I mean,
send an email to everybody in the firm because it might not just have come to you.
I hate the saying for various reasons because it seems such a cliche. If you see something, say something. Well, we're not going to be secure in this particular world unless we talk to people we care about things like this. All right, client requirements. We've talked about this. They're increasingly the bane of our existence, some of us anyway. You need to be aware of them. Let's keep going here. Talk about this. Talk about communication with clients about confidentiality. Number 18.
I do a lot of divorce work, and I have for a number of years, ever since everybody wanted to do everything by email, and that's great and wonderful, I have actually had a conversation with every potential client in that first conference, and I have a form that I make them read and sign that explains several things. Number one, email is not confidential. If you're emailing your lawyer about your strategy in your divorce case from your home computer that your husband has the password to, or where you tend to leave your Gmail account open all the time, your spouse is going to be reading your deepest, darkest strategic secrets to your lawyer. It's a dumb idea. I make them write down what email address I am authorized to communicate with them at. I educate them that if it's their work email address, he doesn't have my work email address. The boss has full access to whatever goes on in there. So when you want to confess to your lawyer that you're having an affair with a coworker, you don't want that on that email. So it is a form that educates them. Requires them to agree and requires them to put information in their handwriting, and it's sort of a CYA for them and for me as well.
Do you ever have people or instruct or request they get a new email?
Oh, I frequently tell people, especially if I can guess their password. You know that surgeons are the worst. They really are. Oh, nobody would ever know my password. Well, your son's names are Harrison and Hendry. Could it possibly be Harrison Hendry? How did you know that?
It's you're brilliant. You just that's all
the
it is.
Psychic powers.
Exactly.
I frequently tell people get another email address and have a password that is something that your spouse would never guess.
Good luck with that.
That little girl you kissed in sixth grade playing spin the bottle, you know, that sort of thing.
Okay. But I think that the broader moral to me is that pretty much all of us, for many, if not all of our clients, we need to start having conversations with them. Especially, for example, real estate closing lawyers. Any in the room know, man, you guys are targets. My gosh, you're targets. And, you know, if you got a new client to do that kind of work, you're going to have that kind of conversation. All right, let's move on a little bit. That's client communication, let's see here. Firm's policies, that's not very important. No, that's very important, but we just don't have time. Closing homily. My view is tech competence is obviously part of our ethical requirement, and tech security is part of tech competence. And so my view is you ought to pick one or two of the topics we talked about today, maybe two or three or four, and pick them and find a way to implement them and be safer about it. Even if all you're doing is maybe not using a VPN, but you go talk to your tech person and say, okay, what's this VPN thing? When does that help? And that's going to lead into a conversation maybe about how you use your laptop on the road. And maybe that leads to a little better security, how you handle that. So that's part of it, is to commit to do a couple of things like that, simple things, small things, baby steps, whatever you want to call them. I also think we all need to figure out, a la Paul Manafort's lawyers, we need to make a resolution personally to routinely continuously improve our tech competence. I don't care what age you are. I don't care how much you really do use tech. You're using it. And that's going to be help you with security. And by the way, I think the best and simplest way to learn new tech competence is in your office. You know, 95% of everything I know about how to use computers came from one of two sources: Jane, my wife, who introduced me to computers to start with, or one of my several secretaries over the years. I mean, honestly, you know, I wouldn't know how to use Word but for that. So, for example, here's a list. Pick something. Pick something you need, you don't do, and you need to know how to do. Like, how to e-file a document, okay? I don't always e-file my own documents. Sometimes I have other people in my office. I need to know how to do that more. There's one system I just haven't learned. Okay, I need to learn that. How to securely redact, we talked about that. How to use track changes, okay? I mean, that's something a lot of clients really like, for example. How to OCR a document and make it searchable. Pick something. But little steps. You don't have to learn how to use, you know, how to code, you know, a program or something. But little steps. That's my pitch. So, we're at the end of the hour.
We are. It's time to call this day done.